Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for clicking on the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. This one really moved me. You're about to meet William A. Noguera. He spent more than 30 years on death row, right across the highway from me at San Quentin State Prison here in California. And he's just published a brand new, powerful memoir called Escape Artist. And William Noguera is a very talented writer and a very talented graphic artist. And his book captures his talents and takes you on a ride that is really incomparable. I've been visiting San Quentin, as I tell William Noguera, for more than 30 years. But he told me stories that I'd never heard before. So sit back and enjoy this podcast, made possible by listeners like you, who sign up for subscriptions for $5 or $10 or $20 a month at peterbcollins.com. People like Cheryl Fleming, Dick Attlee, Billy Cook, and Jeffrey Stewart. I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on Become a Subscriber. Takes you to the sign-up page. And there you can make a choice. And I invite you to pause this podcast right now to take out a new subscription. You'd be doing me a big favor. And this piece of our opening music is Michael Franti and Spearhead. If you've never heard the album Stay Human, I hope you'll check it out online. It's available at YouTube for free. It is a powerful look at the death penalty and an execution that was scheduled and then canceled. It's quite a concept album, and I hope you'll check it out. Joining me today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, a talented visual artist and an extremely talented writer, William A. Noguera. That's the Marvelettes from the Peter B. Collins Tax Deductible Music Archives, rocking us into a powerful conversation with William A. Noguera. His brand new book, just published this week, is called Escape Artist, Memoir of a Visionary Artist on Death Row. And William A. Noguera joins me from San Quentin State Prison, which is less than half a mile from my secret studio here in San Rafael, California. William, thanks for being with me today.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
You have done amazing things with your life behind bars, and this book that you just published is really mind-blowing. And William, I want to tell you that I have visited San Quentin over 100 times in the last 35 years, never had the chance to meet you, but I like to tell it this way, that I've never been invited to spend the night. And I have been given access. I toured the West Block one time, and I've been on the yard and some of the other facilities. But you're in that prison inside the prison on death row, where you are highly segregated, and your access to the general population is almost zero. Is that correct?
It is actually just zero. The prison itself, San Quentin, has a surrounding wall, and death row is in the east block as well as the north seg of the prison. And the only time that we walk onto the main line or to the general population is under heavy escort and cuffed and chained at all times. So my access and my experience with the main line is extremely limited to those a few occasions that I visit the doctor or am I to leave the prison for some reason? But yes, I'm completely isolated from the mainline.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really strikes me about the way you have handled your incarceration is that you are fiercely independent, and you don't align with any gangs, or it sounds to me like you're a real loner, and you simply do not get swayed by the pressure of the gangs and the other forms of institutionalized segregation.
Yes, and that is something that I had to, as the book explains, that when I first arrived here, I was very young. I was 23 years of age. I was one of the youngest men on death row, and I had to become an individual. I had to come to grips that, you know, I was going to do this thing alone, and I was going to do it my way, and not by continuing with prison behavior or accepted prison behavior. And I've exactly done that. I've done it as an individual, and I preach the doctrine of individualism. And you have to be a strong individual. You have to be firmly situated in your path and not stray from it. And I think the book illustrates that in very powerful terms, with visual aids and with the, you know, the literature that goes with that, being that type of individual.
Now, you describe how you developed your skills at drawing and art very early in life, and it's been a form of escape for you and creative expression. But where did you learn to write? I mean, this is so impressive. It's graduate-level English major writing, in my opinion. And from the book, it seems that, you know, it was a squeeze to get you out of high school.
Thank you so much for that. You know, but the truth of the matter is, I just wrote from the heart. It's, you know, literature, writing.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
It's very much like art. Art, whether you're self-taught or you've gone to the best universities in the world, you're in the art circle or you're not in it. Art is not about, you know, correctly doing anything. It's about what's inside of that person, how that person expresses himself. I wrote from the heart. You're right. I did not like high school. I did not want to finish school. I spent most of my time, you know, surfing or daydreaming or drawing. But when I sat down to write this book, I really had some hopes in my mind that when people read the book and read about my experiences, that it would help them in some way, shape, or form not make the mistakes I've made, or if they've made mistakes, then that individual could then draw hope that they someday can also draw the strength to excel somewhere in their life and do good or help another person. I think that motivation right there is what propelled me to write in such a manner that, as you said, made it seem like I was, you know, I'm trained at writing, but I'm not. I just wrote from the heart, and I spoke the way I speak, and I spent 35 years, nearly my entire life, uh-huh, my bars, reading books, and I've just tapped into that that recorded memory that I have of just talking.
And William, when you describe how you go into a kind of altered state, if you will, when you're working on a piece of art, and the book includes many photographs of your artwork, and it is as impressive as your writing. But when I read those passages, it reminded me of Mumia.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Got it. Reminded me of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And the descriptions of how, you know, because they have denied him just fundamental things like an ink pen that he could write with, that he would use the insert of a Bic pen, you know, the ink part and the ballpoint, and his fingers would bleed as he wrote his commentary pieces and articles and books that he has created while he's behind bars. And I really put you on a par with Mumia.
Yes. Being in these circumstances that, unfortunately, the both of us find ourselves in, really lends to the to finding that not only voice inside you, but, you know, I've always said that the worst thing in the world is to find your potential behind these bars. But if you're meant to write, if you're meant to do something good, if you're meant to rehabilitate yourself, and you've come to that state of mind, it's going to happen no matter what odds are against you. And that's why I believe that the human spirit, no matter what you do to it, if you want it to rise, it's going to rise, and you're going to change. So I can only but applaud those other men and women who have found themselves in dire straits, not necessarily in prison, but have just come across a very difficult time in life, and they've risen above that. So I definitely bow and tip my hat to them and all people that do that.
And William, I've met dozens of prisoners, many of them lifers, a handful of those convicted of capital crimes. And I've always been impressed with the resilience and the resourcefulness that many incarcerated people demonstrate. And I have a friend who's one of your neighbors, and I know there are over 800 guys on death row, so I don't expect that you're buddies. But James Anderson is a death row inmate who has trained himself as an artist while he's in prison. And it is a great form of expression for him and, a deep source of satisfaction and reward as the endless hours go by.
Well, yeah, as I've said, I commend anyone who tries to better themselves through education, the arts, through writing, through any form that they can find to become better people and better persons in this world. I can only speak for myself in this situation. I was never satisfied with having the opinion of me being a person who should be condemned and who should die. So from the very beginning, I chose to stay away from gangs, as you mentioned, and as the book describes. And I had to do so in a manner which really put out the message that I should be respected for the person that I am. I've always held to my convictions, and there are those who might like it, those who may not like it, but I've always been true to that moral code that I live my life with and by. And even today, now where I do certain lectures at MBA schools on professional conduct and ethics, I live my life a certain way. Every day, no matter what, I have to look in that mirror at myself. And although I have many regrets, I definitely feel that I've lived my life in a manner that I can look at myself and feel that I have taken a situation and turned it around.
William A. Noguera is my guest on the Peter B. Collins podcast today. His new book is called Escape Artist, and it is a powerful depiction of his life. It's beautifully edited, William, where we go from a chapter about your childhood to a chapter about your time in the Orange County Jail to your longer-term incarceration at San Quentin. And I want to read a passage here. It's a bit lengthy, but and I know the operator's going to interrupt us here in a minute, so I will keep reading while you dial me back. But this is a passage where you say, you could live next door to a prison and still be light years away in terms of understanding the rules that govern prison society. After years in prison, men's hearts blacken, and many become creatures of violence. Paradoxically, while they're dangerous, they're also weak. They commit violent acts because they want acceptance. In fact, they will do anything they're told by the gangs to earn that acceptance.
We have 60 seconds remaining.
Make no mistake, I am capable of extreme acts of violence, and I've had my share. For me, it's a matter of survival. I get no pleasure from violence other than to defend myself and demand respect. The fact is, respect is necessary in prison. Without it, you become someone's punk and property, or risk being killed. In here, the most respected and honored men are those who have killed other prisoners. The more potential a man has for that ultimate outcome, in here, the most respected and honored men are those who have killed other prisoners. The more potential a man has for that ultimate outcome, the more respect he receives. And you describe many scenes where you are attacked and you defend yourself in a what I would call a brutal manner. And so I have to say that in addition to being a talented artist and a great writer, you have terrific command of the language of violence, William.
Unfortunately, that's a part of my life that I've had to live through since being a child of abuse and being bullied throughout my teenage years and my years as a small child. And nothing has changed in the world that I live in today. It's unfortunate that men, grown men in prison, find violence as a language to speak, and that the most respected men are, in fact, those with the highest capacity to reach that ultimate goal, which is to kill somebody else. It's unfortunate. And I say that with the deepest remorse and regret that I have to defend myself in this environment. I don't like it. I wish I lived in a world that I could be just an artist, an author, a man who's trying to help other people. But again, unfortunately, the men in here, some of which are horrible people, like to victimize people. And I will defend myself as any human should when attacked. And these men are not attacking you with words. They're not attacking you with tweets or Facebook letters. They're attacking you with a weapon, hoping to do one thing, harm you. And as unfortunate as it is and sad as it is, I've had to, on a number of occasions, defend myself against these attacks. I don't do so with any kind of pride or anything else, but ultimately, my will to survive and my will to live will ultimately win, and I will defend myself, and that's all I can really say about it, but it's unfortunate and it's sad, and I wish the prison system had more of a compassionate form of understanding these men to give them the education they need in order to change. But that being said, a lot of them will never change because they really like who they are, for whatever, for better or for worse.
A couple of comments, William. One is I have deep respect for your individualism and for your lack of any need for approval or for, you know, acceptance by other people. I think that shows great inner strength. I also this issue is the reason I chose "Don't Mess with Bill" as the music to open this interview, because I certainly wouldn't mess with you, and clearly the altercations that you have been involved with send a clear message to people: don't mess with William A. Noguera.
Well, yes, the book and how I wrote the book, I definitely had to be candid and authentic about what happens behind these prison walls. You know, I couldn't just write and say, hey, life is great, I paint, I write, goody for me. I wanted the audience to understand what the consequences of actions or my actions or their actions can be. That if you commit a crime, this is what awaits you. I've often seen these memoirs out about people have gone to a jail, to a prison, and those prisons have been nothing more than a country club with lakes where you can lie beside it. There are a number of TV shows now that are based on that, or a housewife's time in prison, or a rapper who went to a jail and was in protective custody the whole time and he felt that he had some kind of street cred. The truth of the matter is that in prison, real prisons, like Trenton, Angola, San Quentin, Folsom, There are no lakes. There are no sharing cookbooks and recipes. These places are designed to break men or turn them into these creatures of violence that I described in my book. Accepted behavior or not accepted behavior, we all as human beings have to have a moral code, what is right and what is wrong. This isn't something you have to learn. When you're a small child, if you take a candy bar and you hide it, you know you've taken something you shouldn't have. It's a moral compass we all are born with. unfortunately for me and others, this moral code, this ethical erosion begins to happen by letting something go. You commit a small crime, and it continues to grow and grow. Until some point, you can't distinguish, and the influences, the peer pressure, you go into accepted behavior. Well, as a man of 23 years of age, I made the decision not to be performing accepted behavior in prison. And you have to be strong to do it. I make no qualms about my position and how I do it. Of course, there are some that don't like it. Some of us take it as a precedent for those, for other and examples for other people who actually can make it without a gang. I leave that to each person to decide. I live my life by a certain set of rules, and I know others have looked upon me and said, look, if he can do it, I can do it. And that's an inspiration I want to give people. That's the reason for the book. If you can see it in the writing, that there is a positive, there is something you can do about your life, no matter where you're at, then you're understanding the language in the book, which is, no matter where you're at, no matter who you are, if you want to do better, if you want to be a better person, the only person who's going to change you is you, period.
And William, I'm struck by a deep and bitter irony that every day when you go out in the yard to do your martial arts workout, your weightlifting, and other routines, you face the risk that another prisoner might try to kill you. And you have to fight to stay alive in order eventually for the state to put you to death.
Well, in both cases, I have no control about what other people are going to do. Another prisoner attempted to attack me. I really have no control. I put myself in a position by not being involved in drug use, gangs, or any of those types of behavior. So my chances lessen. If you get involved with those things, of course your chances rise. The state of California trying to execute me is something I can't control. The only thing I can control, obviously, is how I respond to situations and how I conduct myself. But I do hope that by leading my life a certain way, the powers that be or the people that observe me will leave me alone, or at least in their minds and hearts understand that I'm not that kid I used to be. I'm a grown man, and I'm not trying to harm anybody. I'm not trying to do anything wrong. I'm simply trying to help others as best the way I can.
William, help our listeners understand what it is like to face this open-ended sentence with the presumption that it will end in the execution chamber. I have a friend who served 23 years, mostly at San Quentin. He was a lifer, a 7-to-life top, and all the years that he did not win parole were very difficult for him. And he said, you know, just give me a date, even if it's 10 years out. That's nothing. I can whack away at it. And I was blown away by that comment. But when I think about the men who remain at Guantanamo Bay and individuals like you on death row, the idea of this, open-ended incarceration has to be very difficult to reach some sort of resolution with. Can you help us understand how you deal with that internally?
Uncertainty is the worst sense of all. Not knowing what's coming tomorrow is the worst thing. I never know if one day a court is going to say, you're done. It's out of my hands. And not knowing that is terrible. If I have a sentence where I know that in 10 years or 5 years, you understand that day and you can deal with the time. You can see the light at the end of the tunnel. So therefore, you just attach a string to it and you just lead yourself down that path. Being in a tunnel with no lights is horrible. And all I can tell you, and this sounds, I don't mean to sound like it's so easy, but when you're in complete darkness, what I did was I reached for the stars. I didn't see any type of limit to what I could accomplish. But the sentence is terrible. Every single day I've lived with death for the past 30-plus years, and it drains on the soul. It kills me every time because each year, each decade that has passed, I still look at that guy in the mirror, and I still see, in some ways, the guy that was 19 or 18 years old. But in another sense, I look at the man, and now there's lines that cover my face. There's my gray hair. I'm old enough to be a grandfather. That is a part of this that just kills, because when you realize your potential and you see it dwindling each year that goes by, it's nothing more than torture. So those men in Guantanamo Bay, men who are in these safe circumstances, they have to look within themselves deeper than anybody else has and find that light. If you can do that, if you can find the light, then you can reach the end of the tunnel, whatever that tunnel might be.
And William, as you confront these issues, what kind of coping skills do you have? Do you read self-help books? Is there anybody who's written a book to help people cope with long-term incarceration that you found meaningful?
You know, that's a good question. Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you one book that I've read about dealing with the situation that's going to help you. You know, you can read cookbooks that learn how to cook, and you can learn how to be anything in the world, but it's very difficult to find a book that teaches you how to survive death row.
Yeah.
So the answer would be no. But, I mean, in the same token, everybody has their own coping mechanism, and I'm sure that people find ways of entertaining themselves or take up their time. You know, I've just chosen to find within myself that strength. I think in any situation, people have to find that strength within us, and we see it all the time. This isn't unique to me or to just people in prison. There are people in life suffering from cancer, suffering from anything, an insurmountable tragedy in their life, and you see them pick themselves up and continue on. And, you know, as cliche as this may sound, but you know, the things that don't kill you make you stronger. And I think that at this point in my life, there's very little that I believe that I can't overcome, no matter what the circumstances may be. So, in my opinion, just, you know, no one changes unless they want to change. And I think when you see good in yourself,
this call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
You see the works of what you do, and you see it come to life. That gives you inspiration. It gives you hope. It gives you, and that's it right there. And that's the word I'm looking for, optimism. Optimism gives a person that hope that something good is going to come of this, whether it be for yourself or for others. And that's the word I was looking for, optimism.
But you must have moments of despair, William.
Oh, absolutely. There isn't a day that goes by that I'm not overwhelmed with emotion, overwhelmed with loss, with remorse, regrets. Oh, every day. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't go through. But at the end of the day, you got to pick yourself up. You have to continue on.
So, William, there's a whole public debate about the death penalty. And in the last big election here in California, there were dueling ballot measures, one to speed up the process and one to eliminate the death penalty. And as someone who has received that ultimate sentence, I'd like to know your opinion. Do you believe that the death penalty is moral, and do you believe that it is effective as any kind of a deterrent to criminals?
You know, that's a very good question, and in the past, I've shied away from that question because, you know, the truth of the matter is I'm not an expert at this. I am, in some ways, the, for lack of a better word, the victim of the system. And I say that not because I was placed in a prison cell. I say that because I've spent 30 years in the prison system going through courts, and there's been delay after delay, not at my behest, not because I wanted it done, but because the system is so bogged down. You have attorneys that can't afford to take on these cases because they actually lose money. You have a prison system, as well as a judicial system, is bogged down with case after case after case. So I guess the real question is, you know, is it morally correct? I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. And I don't think I'm the smartest guy in the world to answer that question, or the best equipped person to answer that question. There are people far more intelligent than I am that can answer that question. But in terms of my experience, 30 years to be going through an appeal process is a very long time. And, you know, it's a horrible system. It doesn't work. And the worst part about it is that unless you have the...
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
The finances, you're not going to get the kind of justice you get. And unfortunately, it happens to the people, the poorest people in the world. The poorest people in the United States have... Because you don't hear of, you know, O.J. Simpson receiving the death penalty. You don't hear of anybody else. They hire the best attorneys in the world, and they ultimately receive the kind of justice you can buy. I'm not in that position, so therefore it's hard for me to comment on it. So as a deterrent, I don't know of anybody in the prison system who has sat there and thought about something and all the legal consequences behind something before they've done something. It's, you know, most people that are committing crimes are uneducated people, and if they are educated, they're not thinking about maybe, yes, the consequences of the action itself, but what consequences come from that, the victim's family, the cost, the consequences to their family, to their loved ones. None of those things cross people's minds that I believe while they're doing something incorrect or criminal. So it's very hard to determine that. And it's also the question of being a lot of young people end up in these circumstances, young people who are uneducated, immature. There's a new law that just came out in California that addresses that issue alone in brain development for people under the age of 23. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things to be considered here. And I'm sorry, but I really don't have an educated opinion exactly on how this affects us as a society and how the death penalty or these long-term sentences affect people, because it seems to me, at least from looking from the inside out, that it has everything to do with politics rather than what's best for someone. Just recently, the California Department of Corrections has added the word rehabilitation. And now these programs are available when men are getting out. And they don't come back to prison because they're being rehabilitated, educated. Education is the most important part of this. And that's what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Through education, I've learned and I've changed a great deal. So instead of maybe putting $80,000, $90,000 a year to keep a person in prison and pay for lawyers for appeals, maybe we should take that money and put it in schools and education for young children before they commit these crimes, to educate them on what we should be doing as a society to take care of those people who most need it. And that's probably the best answer I can give you.
William, react to this, please, because I've often argued that the death penalty is a rational construct. People say, well, you take a life, your life should be forfeited. The issue I see, though, is that mostly the actions of someone who commits murder are not rational. And you've described your own type of rage, and it was fueled by steroids that your dad gave you when you were beefing up, bulking up, and turning into a really powerful fighter as a teenager. And so my argument is that, for the most part, murder and these other capital crimes are not rational acts. And to try to squeeze them into a rational frame, I think is irrational.
Well, I think your point of view is very rational. You obviously have thought about it, and you're right. For most people, young adults, young offenders, or most people in general, they committing a crime is not really a rational act, especially one where they have responded to another situation. So you're absolutely right. There's nothing that can be explained about it except that you're trying to rationalize an irrational act. And in some cases, by giving someone the ultimate sentence for that, it is a tragedy, because we have to look further than just the act itself, and we have to look to see what motivated it. And so I think you're absolutely right.
I want to read your opening passage here from chapter 28. In these pages, you may come to the conclusion that I'm a contradiction. You would not be alone in thinking so. On a number of occasions, I've even been referred to as a perfect contradiction. I'm a man well-read who understands a progressive state of mind as well as the sensitivities of the soul. And yet the polar opposite exists side by side in good standing. I'm a Neanderthal, a man ruled by primal instinct and animalistic focus. I am both sides of the coin, and I make no excuses for who I am. I refer to it here in order for you to understand there is truth and value to both sides. What may not be apparent is that I am afraid. Fear is at the center of this existence. Each day I live behind these brutal walls. I fear for my life and of disappearing as an individual. Fear triggers the inferno deep inside me that rebels and struggles against the opinion that I deserve to die, that I have nothing to contribute, and that I will be defined by my surroundings, thus becoming one with them. William, this is so powerful, so rich and insightful. This is what led me to say that you are writing, you know, at the level of a PhD English Lit scholar. And it's very profound and moving for me to read your characterizations of your own experience. It's just amazing.
Well, thank you so much for that. I think that passage there illustrates exactly how far I've come and how much I think about my existence. You know, fear is at the center of everything that I live, breathe, and do. I've been afraid since I was a child. It's one of the reasons that I've wore all these masks over the years, so I can hide from those who were trying to harm me. So that passage right there, it's funny that you picked that particular passage. It really does illustrate in very short term, in terms, exactly what the book is about. It shows all sides of me and explains how I got to those places and how, as a man, I reflect on those things every single day that I live in this existence and survive. It's when you were reading it, it immediately tightened my stomach. Mm-hmm. You know, you're reading to me my words, things that I think about, my philosophies. These are the philosophies that I live my life by. So as you read, my stomach tightened, and a part of me awakened again because of those words. They're very true and very powerful.
William, you also narrate your developmental years, and I have to say that it was a little bit of a hoot for me to read about the way you chopped up cars, particularly Volkswagens. I used to own a 72 Beetle, and more recently I had a Passat. But you specialized in stealing Beetles, Volkswagen bugs, and you would swap chassis and body, change the VIN numbers, and then really trick them out with big engines and high-powered stereo systems and all that. And it really took me back to that era. And you really colorfully capture the surf culture of Orange County, California, and the VW bugs. That must have been quite a, you know, certainly it was a period where you were taking a lot of risks. But it appears that for a time, you were pretty much on top of your world.
That is true. And the scene you're speaking about, the California VW trend or VW bug, that was going on in California, Southern California at the time. And yeah, you're right. There was a point in my life that that's what I did. And I took great pride in what I did and basically being a thief, which, you know, I've never tried to glorify what I did. What I did was completely wrong, and it was a mistake. But I had to illustrate what it was to be in that culture at that time, and the reputation that I had at that time made me feel, moments of complete euphoria. I felt almost as proud as you would say of writing a book or creating art or having an art show. What I was doing then made me feel like my life had purpose. And, I graduated from Volkswagens to high-end performance cars. And it was a really interesting culture that I described in ways that some would take as being glorifying it. But in simple terms was I was a young kid that was struggling with life and acceptance, and I did things at that time to make myself feel better. And I did so by taking property that wasn't mine. And, you know, it's a sad situation, but so true. And, yeah, to feel like I was on top of the world back then, now as an adult man of nearly my mid-50s, I can only shake my head and think, dear God, what was I thinking back then? What made me do the things that I did back then? But all you have to do is read the book and know exactly why I did what I did.
But, William, let me borrow your phrase. I can see both sides of the coin here, all right? I do understand that what you did was wrong, and I don't countenance it or promote that kind of behavior for other people. But you did it. It's a fact. And the other side of that coin is you were goddamn good at it.
I took, as I said, a lot of pride in being one of the best. And I used to study marks or cars like I studied, you know, literature or studied art or studied anything else I've done. I am a perfectionist, and that's exactly what it was. I wanted to become bigger, better, faster, and I did so with all of my strength and all of my focus. And that's what it led to, and that's what the things that led to that ethical erosion in my life. But yeah, you're right. I want to be the best. And it's exactly what it was.
William, last year I sat on a local jury here in Marin County, my first experience. And it was a conundrum for me because the guy was, we had to convict him. He evaded the highway patrol on a motorcycle at speeds up to 150 miles an hour. But he had a pretty good story about what provoked him, and I was trying to work the jury for a misdemeanor instead of a felony. And I also, when we returned our verdict, I wanted the opportunity to say he broke the law, but he was a really skilled motorcycle rider. And unfortunately, they don't give us those kind of an option in a jury box.
I can see your point in that. Yeah. I definitely can see your point.
William, during the 1980s, I got to know Warden Dan Vasquez over at San Quentin a little bit, and I found him an interested and complicated figure, and I had some empathy for the job that he does, which is dealing with, at that time, about 5,000 or more inmates, and also trying to manage the guards. And the guards have a very powerful union that often prevents disciplinary action and other appropriate measures that a warden would like to take. So I have an appreciation for Dan, and your book deepened that, because when he was made aware of your skills as an artist, he made some major efforts to encourage you. Tell our listeners about that.
He did. Warden Vasquez, in my opinion, is a very interesting man. I think he also had a set of principles he lives his life by. And I think the other convicts here appreciated his honesty, his straightforwardness. You know, he always kept his word, and he did that with me. When I first arrived at San Quentin, you know, I was kept in an isolated cell for a very long, extended period of time where I drew my first mural. And he was made aware of it. He came to see it, as did an associate warden. And, you know, he made a deal with me. He told me when I went in front of their committee, although I thought that the process was a little, weird and canned, and I didn't think that they were going to give me a chance. You know, he basically told me. He saw what I had done. He said that I had a lot of talent. And he watched me. He observed me. He wanted to know, you know, Who was William Noguera? You know, he's been sentenced to death. He was brought here. But who is he as an individual? And he watched me. And he, you know, kept his word. I didn't commit any problems or crimes during my time in the adjustment center. He let me out, allowed me to go to East Block. He took it upon himself to call the art program and had them bring me materials. And he watched me. he wanted to know if I was going to do with my talents what others had done in the past, which is tattoo other inmates or use the proceeds from their work to buy drugs. Or he watched me, and he saw what I was doing. He saw that every dime that I made, I sent out. I didn't keep the money, but I donated to charity. He was watching me, and all I can say about Warden Vasquez is that he's a man of principle. Kept his word to me. He gave me a shot. Of course, I took that shot and made everything I could, and I believe I've surpassed all his visions of what I could have done. But he told me, he said it very clearly when I first met him, that he's seen a lot of artists come through San Quentin. He said, granted, not many with the talent that you have, but what are you going to do with it? Am I going to look back several years from now and see you doing what everybody else has done, or are you going to be different? Are you going to be the one? I think I've proven myself to Warden Vasquez that the chance he took on me was well taken, and I haven't let him down.
Well, and William, let's acknowledge that you have been really appreciated on an international basis, and your works have been displayed in galleries around the world. And on the first day of publication of your new book, Escape Artist, The Guardian from London ran a really great profile of you with quotes from the book. And I think that's an indication that you have become internationally recognized, despite the fact that you're locked up at San Quentin.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, again, it's very humbling to me that my work is being displayed and people are appreciating what I'm doing. You know, it's not always been the same for me. As you've known, I've exhibited in the United States several times in different galleries. I've had some bad experiences with art dealers and the such. But you're right. Being recognized and that possibly my work can do some good really is a humbling experience for me. I feel good about it. I feel like maybe there's so much more I can do. And I hope that, you know, comes to a certain level soon.
And tell us about your mission at the William A. Noguera Trust. I know that under the law, you know, inmates are not allowed to keep what are seen as proceeds from telling their story or you know, selling things that they create. But you took that in a different direction. And who are the beneficiaries of your trust?
Well, the trust is obviously, it's a private trust, the William A. Noguera Trust, and it is managed and taken care of by the executive director of that trust. The benefit, people that benefit from that trust are our charity. We put certain pieces up for donation, and the proceeds from that go directly to a particular charity that we choose. I hope to do more, but everything, it goes slowly in this world, and I can't do as much as I wish I can do. Sometimes the charities don't accept donations, but we've made it very clear that this endeavor is about giving back, about helping people, about educating people, and that's why I speak at different, I've spoken at Endicott College and MBA programs, and it's for that reason, to give back. So the people who benefit from the arts and whatever I can do are people in the general public. It's important to me that this debt be paid in the best manner I can, and those are the benefactors of the work.
And would you care to share a story of someone who has received money from your trust and any kind of a good outcome from the funding of their work or their needs?
Well, for many years, the trust is fairly new. For many years, I gave just anonymously to children's charities. I sent a check, and I left it at that. And I realized that I wasn't giving the most important part of which was myself. So I thought that leading by example was a much better alternative. By showing people that I give to charity, maybe other prisoners, maybe other people in life will also take that upon themselves to help somebody else in need. I don't know anybody in particular because we give to a charity itself. Mm-hmm. The charity then takes the money and does whatever they do with it.
I see.
I'm not involved directly with that, but I do hope that I do somebody well, and that's all I can do right now. Maybe someday I can do it in a more personal level, but for now we have the charity page on the website, and there are pieces there that people can donate directly to the charity once the donation is given and a receipt is given to the trust. The painting is shipped to that particular person, and they enjoy the artwork, and a person in the world enjoys that benefit, or a group of people enjoy that charity.
And I will put up a link to your website in the show file for the podcast, so it's easy for listeners just to click over. And it's William Noguera, Noguera.com. Well, William, again, I commend you on a powerful book on the kind of self-directed development that you exhibit, not wasting time in prison and feeling sorry for yourself and, you know, just giving up. And you offer a model for people who are not incarcerated, whose lives make them feel like they have limited options or they, you know, can't get out of the house maybe. And I want to encourage people to pick up your book and read it. So as we wrap up, I'd just like to ask if you have any thoughts that you'd like to share or anything that I didn't bring up that's in the book that you would like to mention for our listeners.
Only that I really appreciate this opportunity for my voice to be heard, which is the reason I wrote the book. I hope it could change a life, inspire someone to do something good, and to take sight of their life and understand the consequences of actions. Good consequences, bad consequences are all in our own power. So I would ask that as they read the book, ask themselves the question, what would I have done? And if they can answer that question candidly to themselves, then I believe that they're on the road already, or they're about to get on the road to possibly having a better life. And I hope the book does change a few lives and help somebody. If I can help somebody in any way, shape, or form, it helps me.
The book is Escape Artist. It is out now in hardcover, I believe. I have a galley proof, so I'm not exactly sure, but it's at Seven Stories Press. It's called Escape Artist, Memoir of a Visionary Artist on Death Row. My thanks to William A. Noguera. Thank you, William.
Hey, thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with William A. Noguera. Send me your feedback. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling underneath.